The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Well, the first time I heard The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll was on a Judy Collins album that I bought in college. I didn't know for many years that the song was written by Bob Dylan. The time, the late 1960s, after the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King, was certainly a time for our tears. Good morning, and welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We're located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, but this morning, thanks to the magic of the internet and Zoom and our wonderful tech team, we are as close as your home. We're a Unitarian Universalist congregation dedicated to nurturing the spirit and transforming the world. I'm Preston Lutweiler, president of the Board of Trustees, and I want to personally welcome you this morning. Wherever you are on your life journey, wherever you are on your spiritual journey, whomever you love, whatever your gender identity or expression, we welcome you into our ever-expanding circle of compassion and caring. If you're visiting us today, you'll notice in the Zoom chat a link to our virtual visitor card. This is a way for you to connect with us and us with you, so please fill it out at any time during the service. The Soul Matters theme for January is Living with Intention. Our sermon today by the Reverend Aidson Wright Riggins III is about hope for humans haunted by the hounds of hell, and is a reference to writings of Howard Thurman, a spiritual mentor to Dr. King. I would like to open with a reading of My High Resolve by Howard Thurman. Keep fresh before me the moments of my high resolve. Despite the dullness and barrenness of the days that pass, if I search with due diligence, I can always find a deposit left by some former radiance, but I had forgotten. At the time I was full orbed, glorious and resplendent. I was sure that I would never forget. I had forgotten how easy it is to forget. There was no intent to betray what seemed so sure at the time. My response was whole, clean, authentic, but little by little there crept into my life the dust and grit of the journey. Details, lower level demands, all kinds of cross currents, nothing momentous, nothing overwhelming, nothing flagrant, just wear and tear. If there had been some direct challenge, a clear cut issue, I would have fought to the end and beyond. In the quietness of this place, surrounded by the all pervading presence of God, my heart whispers, keep fresh before me the moments of my high resolve, that in fair weather or in foul, in good times or in tempests, in the days when the darkness and the foe are nameless or familiar, I may not forget that to which my life is committed. And now Sandy Beckius will light the chalice with words from Rebecca Savage. Then I will light the peace lamp.
For restorative justice. May it melt away the tethers that uphold whiteness in our midst. May it spark in us a spirit of humility, and may it ignite in us a radical love that transforms our energy into purposeful action. The chalice of audacious hope, this chalice shines a light on our shared past, signaling our intention to listen deeply, reflect wisely, and move boldly toward our highest ideals.
After I light the peace lamp, your response will be, and with all the people of the world. May peace be with us, and with all the people of the world. Our gathering song will be hymn number 121, We'll Build a Land, performed by Mo Mack and John and Cynthia Bowling. The music is by Carol McDade. The original lyrics were by Barbara Zanotti, but MOMAC has revised a few words and added a verse. The words will appear on your screen.
We'll build a land where we bind up the broken. We'll build a land where the captives go free, where the oil of gladness dissolves all mourning. We'll build a promised land that can be. Come build a land where sisters and brothers, filled with the Spirit, may then create peace. Where justice shall roll down like waters, and peace like an ever-flowing stream. We'll build a land where we bring the good tidings to all the afflicted and all those who mourn, and we'll give them garlands instead of ashes. We'll build a land where peace is born. Come build a land where sisters and brothers, filled with the Spirit, may then create peace. Where justice shall roll down like waters, and peace like an ever-flowing stream. We'll build a land where the forests are fertile, where the water and wind run clean and clear, and community matters more than possessions. Come share this land, let's build it right here. Come build a land where sisters and brothers, filled with the Spirit, may then create peace. Where justice shall roll down like waters, and peace like an ever-flowing stream.
One more time.
Oh, come build a land where sisters and brothers, filled with the Spirit, may then create peace. For justice shall roll down like waters, and peace like an ever-flowing stream. And peace like an ever-flowing stream.
Reverend Aidson Wright Riggins III has given sermons at our fellowship before. He's an inspiring preacher. He is also mayor of Collegeville and a personal friend who I know as Ace. He served as director many years ago of the Peace and Justice Ministries for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of Greater Los Angeles. And while in Los Angeles, Reverend Ace had the transformative opportunity to meet with Howard Thurman and study his work shortly before Thurman died in 1981. We're truly honored to have Reverend Ace in our pulpit today.
Perfect love casts out fear. There is no fear where love exists. Rather, perfect love banishes fear. For fear involves punishment, and the person who lives in fear has not been perfected in love. I want to talk today about hope for humans haunted by the hounds of hell. I'm grateful for this invitation to speak here at the Thomas Paine Fellowship on this Martin Luther King's 93rd birthday. Had he lived, he would have turned 93 years old yesterday. At just 39 years old, King was killed 1 year to the day after his famous Beyond Vietnam speech at Riverside Church in New York City. He was killed the day after his I've Been to the Mountaintop sermon, preached to disenfranchised, disinherited sanitation workers at the Mason Temple Church of God in Christ headquarters in Memphis, Tennessee. I often think about Martin Luther King standing at that magnificent Riverside Church, renouncing the terrifying triplets of racism, militarism, and materialism, describing the United States government as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. It was in the church that King outlined Vietnam's devastation at the hands of deadly Western arrogance, noting that we, the nation and the church, are on the side of the wealthy and the secure while we create hell for the poor and disenfranchised. I still remember the blowback and the pushback and the white backlash that Martin Luther King received. The dreamer had become the nightmare for those who held the reins of power. Many wanted King dead, safely dead. He had failed to be a sycophant to white supremacy. He had failed to be uncritically patriotic. I also think about King addressing those garbage workers the night before he died, before he said, "I have been to the mountaintop." I recall him also saying, "I can remember when Negroes were just around, so often scratching where they didn't itch and laughing when they were not tickled. But that day is all over," he said. "We mean business now, and we are determined to gain our rightful place in God's world. And all that's whole about this thing, we aren't engaged in any negative protests and any negative arguments with anybody," he said. "We are saying that we are determined to be men. We are determined to be humans. We are saying that we are God's children. And that because we are God's children, we will not be forced to live like we've been living. We know that there is a coming out," he said. "For when people are caught up with that which is right and they are willing to sacrifice for it, there is no stopping point short of victory." King's Beyond Vietnam speech and his mountaintop sermon were both delivered in churches and delivered to congregations on behalf of people and to people who were haunted by the hounds of hell. Now, I always knew that King was fueled by his faith with his social activism. Yet my own experience had taught me that not all faith fuels positive social transformation. I had witnessed faith in my life that was too often stale and stagnant and sterile and stifling. I had personally been a victim of civil religion that was oppressive, regressive, and tyrannical. What was King's faith? For many years, I inquired about the substance of that faith, as to what made him so strong. Years later, a clue to answering these questions came to me when I learned that King traveled with and always kept close a copy of Howard Thurman's book, Jesus and the Disinherited. To understand King, we need to know a little something about Howard Thurman. You see, Howard Thurman was a Black 20th century prophet mystic. He was raised by his formerly enslaved grandmother, who had offered an emancipatory way of moving forward for people who lived with their lives facing terror, horror, hypocrisy, and hatred. Vincent Harding described Thurman's life's goals as offering the harrowing beauty of the African-American experience as it engaged with the religion of Jesus as a humanizing and liberating way of being, moving towards a fundamentally what he called unchained life. Thurman believed that this life was available for all women and men everywhere who hunger and thirst for righteousness, especially for those who live with their backs up against the wall. We know Thurman as a pastor of the first intentionally racial, interracial congregation in the United States. That was the Fellowship of All People in San Francisco, California. Thurman attended Morehouse College, Rochester Theological Seminary, and did further graduate work at Oberlin School of Theology at Haverford and at Haverford College here in Pennsylvania, studying under the Quaker philosopher Rufus Jones. Notably, Thurman studied under Gandhi in India and had been a student with Martin Luther King Sr. at Morehouse College. And his wife, Sue Bailey, had been a classmate with Alberta King, the mother of Martin Luther King, at Spelman College. They were friends of the King family. I find it intriguing and amazing as to how history continues to unfold God's purpose as it colludes and cooperates with us. You see, King and Thurman had met informally at Howard Thurman's house when King was a doctoral student at Boston University. Thurman was then the dean of Marsh Chapel at the university. They were all watching the World Series in 1954 on a small black and white television, and they began to discuss the possibility of King following Thurman there at the Fellowship Church in San Francisco. Can you imagine that moment for this young doctoral student? Do I follow Howard Thurman as the pastor of the first fully racially integrated, welcoming, liberal, intellectually sophisticated congregation in the United States in the Golden State of California? Or do I accept the call to succeed Vernon Johns at Dexter Avenue in Montgomery, Alabama? You see, Johns was widely known in the Black community and across the South then for his profound scholarship in the classics and his highly controversial and outspoken sermons on race relations that were ahead of his time. Just imagine that. Howard and Sue Thurman, Martin and Coretta King, watching a baseball game on a small black and white TV in Boston, Massachusetts, just months before the United States Supreme Court had declared segregation in public schools unconstitutional in Brown versus the Board of Education. And then just months later, the 14-year-old body of Emmett Till would be found at the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. Such are the vicissitudes of life, and such are the mundane settings in which the cataclysmic world-changing events are lodged. We know that King chose ultimately to go to racially segregated Montgomery, Alabama, and assume the pastorate of a black church over the racially integrated and ecumenical church of Fellowship of All People there in San Francisco. Nevertheless, it appears that when he left that meeting, he also left that meeting with a copy of Howard Thurman's book, Jesus and the Disinherited. And he read that book at the launch of the Montgomery bus boycott and continued to read it. Can you imagine what would have happened if King had decided instead to make his life in San Francisco, rather than in that small, struggling, racially segregated congregation there in Montgomery, Alabama? For King, that book became a manual for providing hope for those haunted by the hounds of hell. Thurman identified three such hellish hounds that haunt people with their backs up against the wall. Those hounds are fear, deception, and hatred. Thurman and King realized that these three threatening powers seek to dominate and to destroy those whom society would disinherit. Most importantly, Thurman and King realized that no external force, however dominating, however diabolical, however divisive, can at last destroy a people if it does not first win the victory over their spirits. Herein is hope, my brothers and sisters. So allow me to repeat that. No external force, however dominating, diabolical, divisive, can at last destroy a people if it does not first win victory over the spirit against them. Now, time and cultural context does not allow me this morning to talk about all three of these hounds of hell. So let me just speak about one of them and the force that allows us to overcome it. And if you invite me back, I'll talk about deception and hatred. But today, let me talk about fear. Fear for Thurman and fear for King. Here's how Thurman describes fear. Thurman says, it is clear that fear arises out of a sense of isolation and hopelessness in the face of the various dimensions of violence to which the underprivileged, the disinherited are constantly exposed. And then we remember what fear was for Martin Luther King. Do you remember that night when he received a phone call in the middle of the night? And it said, N-word, if you don't stop what you're doing, we'll blow your house off, blow your house up. And in 3 days, we will kill you as well. And then it is described with Martin King praying over a cup of coffee. And as he explained in that prayer what fear was like for him, when he said, Lord, I'm down here trying to do what's right. I'm trying to do what's right. I think the cause that we represent is right, but Lord, I must confess that I'm weak now. I'm faltering and I'm losing my courage, and I can't let people see me like this, because if they see me weak and losing my courage, they will become weak as well. Now, I know a little something about that kind of fear, because all my life I've been exposed to that kind of that threat of violence. I remember when I first experienced this kind of fear. I was about 8 years old when my family was taking a road trip from Southern California to the Southern United States to see my kinfolks. And my daddy was driving me and my sister Margaret, who happens to be on the call right now, and Candy and Sandra, and all of us in the backseat of the car, along with my mother. Now, to understand the context, you got to understand my father. My father was always Mr. Riggins in my neighborhood. To understand the context, you need to understand that everybody looked up to my daddy. He was some kind of man. He was a man's man. And I never saw him really afraid of anybody. The only time I saw him afraid, maybe a little bit afraid, was when we would visit Sequoia National Park or Yosemite and the grizzly bears walking around. But that's a different kind of a fear. And he would always do what was necessary. He knew how to handle that. Lock the meat up in the car, make sure that everybody's protected, keep a hatchet nearby. So that was not the fear that we're talking about, but the fear that I experienced on that road trip. And we stopped for gas one day. And Mr. Riggins, A. Sam Franklin Riggins Jr., I saw him go into kind of a step and fetch it routine. Saw his voice change. I saw his back curl. Can I get $5 worth of Ethel? That was the first time I'd ever heard and seen my father act that way. I didn't know at the time that years before, my father and his family had been escapees from a sharecropping plantation in Irish Ridge, Texas. I didn't understand at the time that my father had grown up in the time in which he had saw lynchings and Black people burned at the stake. I didn't understand at the time that a Black man who would lick a white man in his eye was in danger of death. Now I knew that my daddy had had a healthy fear of Mr. Johnson, who lived next door, who had a drinking problem and occasionally would beat his wife, and my daddy would step in and deal with that. And I understand that he kind of had a, you know, cautious about that, but he understood that he might win or lose that battle. And he understood that he might take some blows and give some blows, but he knew that he'd be okay. But in that setting, in driving that car through the South, I saw a fear that was devoid of the element of contest, because he knew that if he faced off, he would lose. I saw a fear that was spawned by the perpetual threat of violence everywhere by everyone who had a white face. I saw a fear that could not demand protection from one's persecutors. I saw a fear that was triggered by the contemptuous disregard for his personhood. I saw a fear that was ultimately degrading and dehumanizing. It was a fear that said Aitzen Franklin Riggins Jr. ultimately did not count in this country and would not be protected. It was this fear of violence that inscribed a certain kind of muscle memory in him and me, that every time I see blinking red and blue lights, something cowers in me. Every time I'm facing a situation where I need to stand up and fight back, but surrounded by mad and angry whites, I know that I cannot really win this one, regardless of how right I might be. When the oppressed don't fight back or push back on the oppressors because of their fear, something insidious, demonic happens in them. But there's also something insidious and demonic that happens in the oppressors. Because you see, my brothers and sisters, the conscience of the oppressor somehow becomes insulated against any sense of wrongdoing. The oppressor begins to assume that the plight of the inferior position of the oppressed is normal. And if that position is normal, then it's correct. And if it's correct, then it's moral. And if it's moral, then it's religious. And if it's religious, then it is in fact ordained by God. This is the only way that enslavement and Jim Crow and lynching and mass incarceration and disparity in healthcare and inequality in education and rollback of voting rights bills and in ad infinitum makes sense in this country. It is also why so many white leaders in this country can call themselves Christian or religious without having an ounce of Jesus in their spirit. But this message is not about what righteous religious white folks should do. Nor was that the point of Howard Thurman's book. For Thurman, it was obvious that if the strong put forth the great redemptive effort to change the social, political, and economic arrangements in which they seem to find their basic security, the whole picture would in fact be altered. But that was not the thesis nor the point of this message. For Thurman, the question was whether or not there was anything in the religion of Jesus that spoke to the paralyzing fear that haunts the disinherited. Is there anything in Jesus's message that would enable my daddy to look Mr. Charlie in the eye? Is there anything in this faith that so many in my generation call a colonizing faith that might be an antidote to acquiescence and acceptance? There is indeed much that Jesus said and did, but allow me to share just a nugget or two from Jesus. Matthew 10. So have no fear of them, for nothing is covered up that will not be uncovered, and nothing is secret that will not be made known. What I say to you in the dark, tell in the light, and what you hear whispered proclaim from the housetops. Do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. And even the hairs of your head, are they not counted? So do not be afraid. You are more than the value of sparrows. And then in Luke, dismiss your fears, little flock. Your Father finds pleasure in giving you the kingdom. So what is it that Jesus offers that enables me to laugh, or enables me not to laugh, when the oppressor tells me something is funny, or not to scratch when the dominant culture tells me that I need to itch? Thurman reminds us that all human beings, including the disinherited, are children of God. It is this God who sustains all of nature and guarantees the intricacies of life process itself. Jesus reminds me that it is unreasonable to assume that the God who knows the number of hairs on Donald Trump's head would exclude from God's concern the life and the spirit of John Lewis. Thurman reminds us that God is not just busy loving everybody in particular. God is loving God individuals individually. God knows each sparrow. God tells us who we are and what we are. Let me see if I can say it this way. 3 years ago, I attended my 50th high school reunion. I graduated from an all-Black high school in 1968. Martin Luther King Jr. had just been assassinated 2 months before. 2 months before we walked across the stage to get our diplomas. Robert Kennedy was killed only days after we had marched. Most of my male classmates found themselves heading to Vietnam by that fall, going off to fight a war for democracy while they were still discriminated against in housing and employment here. Tommy Smith and John Carlos were ostracized in the Olympics in Mexico City because they had bowed their heads and raised their fists during the national anthem. Richard Nixon had been elected the 37th president of the United States in my freshman year in college, while George Wallace, the former Alabama governor, recaptured almost 14% of the popular vote in five southern states. And when we met in that ballroom hotel, those of us who had lived then to be 68 years old and lived to tell about it marveled and rejoiced. Yes, many of us had been divorced and remarried three or four times. Yes, many of us were addicted to alcohol and substances. Yes, many of us were obese and diabetic and had high blood pressure. Yes, some of us had strokes and heart attacks. And yes, some of us were living on meager pensions and dependent on our children for substance. But when we came together in that ballroom, those who could come, we realized that we were yet alive and not crushed like so many of our classmates. And what characterized most of us there was, despite having been warped and despite there being so much wrong about us, we had managed to survive by holding by onto a thin, slender thread because we knew who we were and whose we were. Howard Thurman says that in this world, the socially disadvantaged person is constantly given a negative answer to these most important questions upon which mental health depends. Who am I and what am I? Thurman declares, and I concur, that the awareness of being a child of God tends to stabilize our ego and results in a new courage of fearlessness and power. Jesse Jackson hammered it home to my generation. I am somebody. I am somebody. I may be poor, but I am somebody. I may be young, but I am somebody. I may be on welfare, but I am somebody. I may be small or Black or brown, but I am somebody. I must be respected, protected, and never rejected because I am God's child. This established for me and others a ground of personal dignity, a sense of personal worth in a world that tries to snatch it from us. It is this sense of dignity that allows us to absorb fear and to project hope. If you were not there alive then, I encourage you to watch John Lewis and them crossing the John Pettus Bridge. And you will see that there was something in them that held their reins. There was something in them that the world cannot explain, because they knew how to deal with fear. To fear another human being, whatever may be that person's power over you, is a basic denial of the very integrity of our own lives. We dare not assign to another human being a preeminence that belongs to God alone. To do so is to submit to a fear that delivers one to one's own destruction. Thurman says that Jesus got it right, and this rightness empowers the oppressed. Be not afraid of them that kill the body, because after that, what more can there do? There is a profound power that comes to you when you realize that death cannot possibly be the worst thing in the world. Again, hear Martin Luther King. This faith transforms the whirlwind of despair into a warm and reviving breeze of hope. King says, fear knocked at the door, but faith answered, there was no one there. In the freedom movement, we sang it this way: oh freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'll be rotting in my grave and go home to my God and be free. So I leave you with this thought from Howard Thurman, as he offers hope for humans haunted by the houndish fear, hell of fear. If a person's ego has been stabilized, resulting in a sure grounding of his or her sense of personal worth and dignity, then he or she is in a position to appraise their own intrinsic powers, gifts, talents, and abilities. He or she no longer views themselves through the darkened lenses of those who are largely responsible for his or her social predicament. He or she can think of themselves with some measure of detachment from the shackles of his or her immediate world. The fact that a person is denied opportunity will not necessarily deter that person. He or she will postpone defeat until defeat itself closes in upon him or her. Do you remember Maya Angelou? At 8 years old, Maya Angelou was living with her mother, and she was sexually abused and raped by her mother's boyfriend. His name was Freeman. She told her brother, who then in turn told the rest of the family. Freeman was found guilty in jail for just one day. And 4 days after his release, he was murdered, probably by Maya Angelou's uncles. Right after that, Maya Angelou was mute for almost 5 years. And this is what she says: I thought my voice killed him. I killed that man because I told his name. And then I thought that I would never speak again because my voice would kill anyone. Her biographer said that it was during that period of silence when Angelou developed her extraordinary memory, her love for books and literature, her ability to listen and observe the world around her. And she went on to become America's poet and memorist and civil rights activist, one of the greatest voices of all time. When you know who you are, it leads you to reclaim your why you are. Just the other day, we learned that Maya Angelou will have her image imprinted on the first coin of the American Women's Quarter Program. And that coin depicts Angelou with her arms uplifted because behind her is a bird in flight and a rising sun. images inspired by her poetry and symbolic way in which she lived. And that coin reminds us of her fearlessness, because she knew who she was and why she was. Remember that poem, "I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings." The free bird leaps on the back of the wind and floats downstream till the current ends, and dips his wings in the orange sun's rays and dares to claim the sky. But a bird that stalks down his narrow cage can seldom see through his bars of rage. His wings are clipped and his feet are tied, so he opens the throat to sing. The caged bird sings with fearful thrill of the things unknown but longed for still, and his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom. The free bird thinks of another breeze, an air of trade wind soft through the sighing trees, and the fat worms waiting on a dawn bright lawn, and he names the sky his own. But a caged bird stands on the grave of dreams. His shadow shouts on a nightmare scream. His wings are clipped and his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing. The caged bird sings with the full thrill of things unknown but longed for still, and his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom. We're told that Martin King and Howard Thurman and Coretta Scott were speaking, and Howard Thurman presented his book to them in 1955, Deep River. And he inscribed in that book, "To the kings, the test of life is often found in the amount of pain we can absorb without spoiling our joy." My brothers and sisters, those who are haunted by the hellish hound of fear can absorb anything the world throws at them and respond with joy and with power. Let no man, let no system, let no principality or power spoil your joy, for there is hope for humans haunted by the houndish hell of fear. God bless you.
Thank you, Reverend Ace, for those compelling words. Please reflect on the sermon and the words of Howard Thurman, Martin Luther King, and Maya Angelou, as we listen to "We Shall Overcome," performed by the Ledyard High School Chamber Choir.
I believe that one day, all children will have the same opportunities for greatness.
I believe that one day, we will all see each other as friends and neighbors.
Let us seek out that which unites us, not divides us.
We must celebrate and embrace our differences to make change.
Now is the time to ensure liberty and justice for all.
We shall.
Now we have come to the portion of the service we call Matters of the Heart, where we hear from those of you who may wish to speak. As you gather your thoughts, please listen to a musical meditation by Isaac Strader, after which Mike McNeil will instruct everyone on raising their hands on Zoom to be recognized to speak.
Then we will bring this time of sharing to a close by singing Spirit of Life, performed by our very own Christine Perry and accompanied by Isaac Strader. And the lyrics will pop up here on the screen in just a moment.
I would like to close with words from Reverend Scott Taylor, The Daring of Our Intentions. May we dare to live from the center of our being. May we make our own choices before others' choices make us. May the fire that burns in our belly light our way. May our collective intention make the world shine anew. And now Sandy Beckius will read words and while I extinguish the chalice.
We extinguish the chalice, but not the light, of hope that we will carry with us into the world.
We're doing the closing song, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, which is recorded by the Fisk Jubilee Singers in 1909. It is believed to be the first recording of this song. That concludes our service. Please listen to the postlude down by the river.